everybody. Welcome to our event tonight. My name is Steve Fitzsimmons. I'm one of six people who helped run this neighborhood association meeting. This is what we call the Good Neighbor Project. It used to be the Midville Heights Neighborhood Watch. And we changed over to the Good Neighbor Project to align ourselves with the Madison Police Department's efforts. And so we have about maybe five or six different neighborhood groups here. And how many people are from Midville Heights? Welcome. How many from other neighborhoods? Okay, what other neighborhoods?
Westmoreland.
I feel like an auctioneer.
We welcome you to Westmoreland.
Okay, so another thing I want you to know, I am taping this, Roger, but it's okay. It's because WIDELP, our local radio station here in our neighborhood, asked us to tape this because he was going to play it on air at some time in the future. That's WIDELP. They have a range of about 10 miles. So they broadcast around Odana, and about by the golf course. So again, I want to welcome everybody here tonight, and I'm going to turn it over to Marge, who will introduce our speaker. Thank you.
Don't you just love Steve? No, he's still himself. So we'll do whatever you say. He's going to say what he wants to say. We love you, Steve. Oh, yes, I'm Mark Schlittman. I'm one of the steering committee members. I want to take just a minute to recognize our steering committee as well. Chris, if you can stand up, and Wendy, and Joel, and Dwayne. And Joy's not here, right? Did I miss anybody? We've been together for about 5 years, and we've been putting together programs like this monthly, and it's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing that you come to them. We really appreciate that, because without you, we wouldn't be here. We wondered many times, we tossed around human trafficking, where people aren't going to be interested, I don't think it happens here, not sure that it's something that our population or our audience would be interested in, and here we are tonight, all of you here, so that's we appreciate that. Before I introduce our speaker, who we're very fortunate to have, and I'll tell you a little bit more about, I asked him if he knows if he's coming or going tonight, because he just started a new job yesterday, promoted, and he doesn't even have his phone or his desk yet, and he's here tonight, so that says a lot about him. But I wonder how many of you, what your image is of somebody, something about human trafficking. Is it that person that's hanging out in a corner someplace in a dark alley, all drugged up? Is it somebody who's maybe begging for a couple dollars from you, or somebody who looks sort of tattered and torn? And maybe those are some of the people, but don't be fooled. Don't be fooled. They're sitting next to you in church. They're sitting next to you in the theater. There are people that are on the street sizing you up to see if you'll be part of the group. There are people who obviously look like you and I all the time, and that's how they get away with this crap, because they look like normal people, if you will. And so what we hope that you take away from here tonight is to not be afraid, but to be much more aware of what's going on our streets, and on the buses, and in the hotels, and in the places that Roger will tell you about tonight, because they're everywhere. 15-20 minutes ago, I was watching the news. There was something on human trafficking on the news tonight about what is going on in our community. We're very, very fortunate that our Madison Police Department took this very seriously, and that they promoted somebody like Roger, and he'll tell you more about it in a minute. He's been with the Madison Police Department for almost 30 years. That's the start of when you're five.
Yeah. 2030.
And for the last 10 years, he's been involved in human trafficking. And again, I won't steal his thunder. He'll tell you a lot more about it. But it's amazing that the police department now has a full-time detective focused solely on human trafficking. And that should say something to all of us, that we are on a cutting edge of where we're about to go in the future with the way that human trafficking is exploding in our community and in our country and in our neighborhoods. As we said, Steve said there are some handles there. We have this little card that will help you to also train yourself, educate yourself more on human trafficking as well. And
not you.
Are you showing up?
Nope.
Okay. So without further ado, Roger is originally from Boston, Massachusetts. He's been with the Medicine Police.
Boston. He's from Boston.
No, when you said Boston.
Boston. I'm from the UP. What can I say? I'll let you talk, Wendy, not me. he's been with the Madison Police Department for close to 30 years, as I already said. He's been a detective since January of 2000 and specializes in investigation of human trafficking and cases involving missing children. Every night on the TV, there's some missing child. I can't believe it. What's going on? Roger is attached to the Madison Police Special Victims Unit. It is a department subject matter expert, multiple, in human trafficking. Roger is part of the Dane County Coordinated Community Response Team for Human Trafficking and works with the local, state, and federal agencies in collaborative effort to address the problem of human trafficking, which includes nonprofits, faith-based organizations, as well as community-based organizations. He has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice from the University of Tennessee and a master's degree in criminal justice from the University of Cincinnati. Wendy, thank you. No, you didn't do this, Krista. Thank you for all the, those notes as well. It's also interesting that how cutting edge we are, that our Midvale Messenger has an article by Executive Joe Parisi and Attorney General Josh Call, who are also involved in and very much aware of and working very hard with human trafficking. So there you are, right on our own local newsletter as well, and we appreciate that. So without further ado, I'll stop babbling just to say we're so grateful you're here. Thank you for your promotion, and thank you for carving out time for us tonight.
Oh, sure.
Would anybody like me to use the microphone at all, or can everybody hear?
Please do.
Okay. Okay, thanks for having me to speak with you tonight. It's so great to see everybody come out to learn about this topic, and it's really important. It's very prevalent in Madison and throughout pretty much all of the United States in certain pockets, but the Midwest is a hub for human trafficking, so it's really important that we explore it, and it's something that we have to address in a collaborative effort. The police can't address it by themselves. It has to be social workers, people who work in the healthcare industry, travel-based industries, community groups, faith-based groups. It really takes a village to try to address the problem and to get services to the victims. And so, I've been doing this for a long time. About 10 years, I kind of got into this by accident. I was working with juveniles and was looking for missing kids. And we'll talk about this in the presentation, but the people that are most risk to be victims of trafficking are young people who are missing from home. We'll get into that a little bit in the presentation. So I was looking for missing kids when they were missing and finding out that they were being exploited by adults that were selling them to other people for sexual services, and then the people that were selling them were keeping all the money. Then we call them traffickers or pimps. And so there is some language, I won't use a lot of it, but there's some language in the presentation, and some of it may be a little bit hard to look at or hard to hear about, and if you need to step out or need me to stop, just let me know. I like to be informal and interactive, so if anybody has questions along the way, just chime in and we can stop, or if you want to share something. As we were talking about in the introduction, we have a special victims unit that's been probably operating for about 2 years that we started, and there's six detectives, and they work together as a team, and they address traditional cases of child abuse, child neglect, child sexual abuse, and they do internet crimes against children, which is people that share child pornography, both in video forms and in images. And so we were trying to get a human trafficking position attached to that. For a little while, it was an issue that we brought through the city council and the budget, and it was approved so this year, so we just started the position yesterday. So I was able to, still doing the same work, but was able to join joined the team, and so I have a citywide focus instead of just in one geographic district. I worked on the south side for a long time, so I'm trying to get acclimated to working downtown. So the land of no parking, so it's interesting to get a parking enforcement person here next night. But anyway, human trafficking, when I first heard the term like 10 years or so, I had all these images in my mind, and anybody want to share what comes to mind when you hear the term human trafficking?
Good to see you.
One of my colleagues from Slave Free Madison, Ron Harrington, good to have you here. So when I first heard the term, you know, I thought like people being smuggled, maybe like a transaction, one person being given to another person for a lengthy term, and that's really not what it is. So there's labor trafficking and sex trafficking, and labor trafficking involves when there's usually an arrangement for somebody to be brought from one place to the other, often over a border with some promise of a job, and once that happens, that person's exploited either through labor or sometimes as a crossover to sex trafficking. But I focus more on sex trafficking, which is when a trafficker uses some form of deception, fraud, or violence to basically take somebody captive. Usually a young person uses various methods to keep them captive and exploits them, selling them for sexual services over and over again, multiple times a day and night, day after day, week after week. And it's one of the most destructive things that we have that's going on in this country, and we'll talk about that. But I wanted to start with a video. It's about 6 minutes long. It's about a project in Kent County, Michigan. So I'll start with that, and then we'll get into the presentation.
Please take a seat. All right. Thank you so much for coming in. I'm Mary, by the way. I'm here tonight. Today, nice to meet you. Don't mind the giant microphone that you had.
I'll try not to.
There are three photos in front of you. If you could just pick one, it doesn't really matter which one it is, and show that one to us.
All right.
Could you describe her to us?
She looks youthful.
I feel like this is one of those situations where if I say he's 23, then he's actually going to be 16.
Hispanic, maybe not full, but part. Similar to me, actually.
Well, I mean, she's young, so probably has a lot of things so far, too.
I would describe him as friendly.
She looks, happy, just a little shy, but confident.
Anything she puts her mind to, she could achieve.
We actually have his story. If you could read that out loud to us.
Okay, Marcus. I grew up really close to my parents.
Adriana. I grew up with my brother and sister.
Amy. I remember watching the Olympics on TV when I was 5 and being totally in awe of the sprinters.
I was the middle child and easily the quietest.
I felt like no one ever saw me or cared.
Dad was too drunk to keep a job, and he never even saw me unless I was in his way.
Mom worked two jobs to make sure we had food for every meal, so she was never here to know when he would hit us.
One day when I went to the mall, like I like to do to be out of the house, a man came up to me and told me I was beautiful and asked me on a date.
On our first date, he drove me around in his car and said we could eat whatever I wanted.
Every time we were together, he bought me something new.
Tom really cared about me, and Tom really made me feel special.
I was in love with him.
After only going out for 3 weeks, Tom offered me a way out of my home and asked me to move in with him.
So when he asked me to have sex with him, I did.
He would put his hand over my face until I couldn't breathe.
Tom had friends over pretty regularly, and I could tell that some of his friends were into me.
So I kept my door locked and hoped that no one would bother me.
After a few nights of crashing there, he said that I still owed him for letting me stay at his place.
He said he had a friend who wanted to spend an hour with me.
He told me I might have to do some stuff, but not to worry about it. It's not a big deal.
When I didn't want to, he slapped me and said no one ever cared about me like he did.
But I didn't know what else to do because I needed a place to stay.
His friends forced themselves on me and took turns while he watched.
One by one, they'd come down to the basement, telling me how pretty I am.
When they're on top of me, I just close my eyes and pretend I'm running.
I'm exhausted, and I don't know what to do.
My name is Adriana, 16 years old.
My name is Marcus, I'm 14 years old.
My name is Amy, I'm 12 years old.
I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
And I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
And I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
That was very different than what I thought. Especially because, like, being a girl and imagining, like, if that was me, like, that's... I don't even know. I can't even imagine what that would be like. She deserves to be a kid. Just like what she is in this picture.
It being so close to home is something that makes me want to jump out of this chair.
I wouldn't think that Grand Rapids is a place where anything like this would ever happen.
Because you don't want it to happen to anybody, and you really don't want it to happen to people that live where you live.
Thank you for sharing her story with us. I'd like to show you something if you wouldn't mind taking her picture and following me to the gym.
You run your heart, your gut, your stomach. It's like, wow. Now it's like I feel like I have this weight of responsibility to see how I can help.
Changes through greater awareness and making people realize that this does happen here and will continue to happen until we decide to make a stop.
So every time I watch that, I've seen it a number of times, but I feel like I get punched in the stomach every time I look at that. And I deal with this all the time. And that's there's some things that were said in there, and it's the people that took part in that project, they didn't realize the gravity of the scale of what was going on in their own community, because this is it's a hidden crime. It goes on, it's underground, it's in the shadows where we can't see it. They also said that it doesn't discriminate. It's both every gender, sexual orientation, every demographic, ethnicity. Human trafficking happens to kids from our own backyard. They're not kids and young people that are coming across the border. They're kids from our own backyard that are often, they're young. Some of them have a turbulent adolescence, mental health challenges, maybe substance issues. They're out away from home, and that's when they get intercepted by people or recruited by people who work for traffickers. And so we'll get into kind of some of the nuts and bolts about it. I usually do this presentation with Jan Miyasaki. She's the director of Project Respect. It's our local, one of our local nonprofit agencies that works primarily with victims, both juvenile and adult victims of sexual exploitation. And it's a wonderful resource, and we work together all the time. And I'm going to skip over some of the slides that are in here. They're more about treatment aspects. Sorry, Duane, I think I... okay. So I just want to read this, and this is a quote from a survivor, and it's really salient to me, and it says, "I'm someone's daughter, and I won't give up until I'm home again. My childhood is tarnished. I shouldn't be here, and neither should my friends down the hall. I miss my family. I dream of them, but their faces are getting blurry. I'm scared that I'll never see them again." And so that's a common theme. And so what traffickers do is the number one goal for them is to isolate their victims from their family, from their friends, take away their methods of communication, and they kind of they convey this message that that person is cut off and they're not going to see their family again, and they use different methods to accomplish that, and it's really sad. And so people ask, you know, why is this such a problem? And it's become one of the most lucrative criminal enterprises in the country. And so, you know, historically, drug dealers, they can make money hand over fist, and if a drug dealer is savvy enough not to get caught, they can make boatloads of money, but it's like a wholesale retail. Once they sell their product, they have to spend more money to get more product, and so they can make money, but they have to keep reinvesting. And I never want to compare a survivor of human trafficking to as a product, but a trafficker doesn't have to do that. Once a trafficker has a victim, that trafficker has minimal costs. They might have to pay for a cheap hotel room, some money to post ads on sites, condoms, fast food. Their costs are minimal, and they can keep selling that victim over and over again, day after day, week after week, and they keep all the money. And if they have more than one victim, they can exponentially increase the amount of money that they make, and so that's why it's become, unfortunately, so popular for traffickers. And so this is from the Polaris Project. It's an organization that they facilitate the National Human Trafficking Hotline. It's a great resource. You can go to their website. It's polaris.org. And you can see legislation that's pending related to this topic. There's a lot of information on their site. And this is a couple years old, but it's kind of a view of the country and where the hotspots are. And you can see, like, East Coast, West Coast, Florida, but you can see the Midwest is a hotspot, and Milwaukee has always been a big hub, and Madison has unfortunately become a hub as well. Trafficking doesn't require that a victim be moved from one place to another. It can happen only in one place. However, the way it usually operates is with the internet. A trafficker can advertise the people that they're selling in multiple cities at the same time, and they can gauge where they can make money, and so they often will move from city to city. And we're right between Milwaukee, Chicago, Minneapolis, Kenosha, Racine, Green Bay, Dubuque. And so we're also by interstate systems, and so Madison is a hub for this. And force, threats, and coercion is kind of usually how it operates. And we'll talk about the different types of traffickers, but there's usually deception that's involved. There's different types of force and coercion that traffickers use to control their victims. What's common here is a trafficker will say, I know you have a family, I know you have a mom and a little brother, I know where you live. If you try to leave or you talk to the police, I'm going to kill your family. Whether they want to carry that out or would actually carry that out, it really doesn't matter. It's what they make their victim believe. Some of them use full-on violence, sexual violence, different methods of kind of taking away that person's empowerment and taking away their self-esteem and kind of letting them know that they don't have a chance to stand up and to get away. And it's the exploitation of that person. So some people refer to it as modern-day slavery. What it really involves, and it applies to both genders, it's when somebody uses deception and fraud, and they lure somebody away, and they use various forms of isolation and violence, and they sell that person for profit, and that's what human trafficking is. So I just mentioned this a little bit, but we'll get into this later, but the average age nationally for when a young person is indoctrinated to human trafficking is about 12 to 14. And so in Madison, it's a little bit older, but it's still around that range. And so the most vulnerable population are kids that go missing from home. And so when kids are missing from home, they may connect with somebody online that they don't really know. They may go meet somebody who introduces them to risky people. But once a young person is away from home, they don't have transportation, they don't have a debit card with money in the bank or cash. They often don't have changes of clothing, food to eat, a way to sustain themselves. And so there's usually an adult there that will be really nice at first and provide those things. And then after a couple of days, it's, I've been spending all my money on you, now you're going to do something for me. And that's when this tends to occur. And this happens, it's every demographic. There are kids from you know, very, some from financially challenged families, some from very well-to-do families, and it really has, in my experience, nothing to do with that at all, nothing to do with race, ethnicity, gender. It's kids that are going missing for various reasons. Sometimes they're running from something that's going on in the home, and sometimes they're leaving to go connect with people outside of the home, and that's where this happens. So, just some social cues. If you think you see somebody that you wonder if they're a victim of trafficking, some of the things that in the indoctrination process is avoiding eye contact. Trafficker will commonly tell a victim, the only person that you look in the eye is me, and if they look anybody else in the eye, there's discipline, there's violence. If you're engaging with somebody who may be a victim, they may give you very scripted answers. They may have like poor hygiene, have injuries from being beaten or sexually abused, may be malnourished from not being fed. Traffickers sometimes will withhold food and water for a couple of days at a time on occasion. So also various different types of medical needs and diseases. Sometimes the healthcare industry are on the front line of having the first contact with victims of sex trafficking. And so we talk to a lot of people in the travel industry and the hotel motel industry, and sometimes older males might be seen trying to rent a room, and a victim may refer to them as daddy. They may try to isolate, keep them alone, keep them from speaking to people in the public, often not having things that, like, normally kids have, maybe an ID, a bus pass, a phone. These are things that a trafficker will take from them, so they don't have anything to identify themselves or any means of independence. So pimps, traffickers are referred to on the street as pimps, and there's a whole culture to being a pimp, and there's these pimp balls that happen yearly in different parts of the country, and pimps get together and they learn from each other and they communicate with each other. It's really disturbing. On the street there are like two categories of pimps, and one is called a Romeo pimp and the other is called a gorilla pimp. And so in the video, part of the story was talking about this person was really nice to this victim and was taking her out to eat and those things, and then all of a sudden it became an instance of trafficking. So a Romeo pimp is somebody that preys on a young person that has low self-esteem, maybe has never been made to feel special before by anyone in their life, and all of a sudden there's this charming older person that's interested in me and is in love with me and taking me places, and I'm going out to eat and having my nails done, and this person really cares about me. And after a couple days, one typical scenario is that Romeo pimp will say, you don't have to worry about anything, I'm going to take care of you, we're going to get you your own place to live, but to get the money we have to do this one thing, and I'm going to take care of it and I'll show you exactly what to do, and then we're going to get you your apartment. That never materializes. That person is indoctrinated into trafficking. They find that they're often one or several victims, and then the Romeo pimp becomes very controlling and aggressive and is no longer nice at all. The dynamics are very complicated. Psychologically, it goes on and on, but sometimes that victim whose self-esteem is attacked may be trying to get it to the point where we're treated nice again, but that often never happens. So a gorilla pimp is different. A gorilla pimp will often access a victim through a recruiter, we call a bottom on the street. And so a gorilla pimp, there's no nicety at all. It's right away, it's complete domination, submission, violence, physical violence, torture, sexual violence. That poor victim knows right away, right from the get-go, that it's like over. There's no chance of escape. Anything that they do to try to fight back is going to be met with extreme violence, and it's really completely destructive. So recruitment, it's one of the really difficult dynamics, and for me as a detective working with survivors of human trafficking, and sometimes I'll work with a young person for a year, 2 years, and be trying to get them resources, trying to get them help. And they're the victims of the most heinous type of crime that there is. And there's a lot of psychological things that happen, but sometimes the victim of human trafficking becomes a participant in human trafficking, and they often become what's referred to as a bottom girl or a bottom. There's another name I won't repeat, but this, it's usually called a bottom girl or a bottom. And what a bottom does is a bottom can improve, and there are males involved in this as well, but a bottom can improve their situation by not having to be sold over and over again every night, by doing other things such as recruiting other victims for the trafficker and indoctrinating those victims for the trafficker, and sometimes disciplining those victims for the trafficker. And so one of the hardest things for me as a detective is seeing somebody that's a bona fide victim of this most horrible crime transition into becoming a participant in it and bringing other young people into that. And that's been the hardest thing for me. And that's a really sad dynamic. And so I clicked over the slide, but typically this happens over social media. So, you know, if you have kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews, it's really important to know who they're communicating with, because the bottom is typically somebody will message on social media, a young person, and say, like, hey, you're really pretty. Do you want to come party? We can hang out. We can make some money. It's not that bad. We're going to have fun. And then once that person is, you know, meets that person, they're taken or introduced to somebody who takes them. And so that's kind of the hard part about this. And so just thinking back on this whole issue of trafficking, you know, in the past, you know, we always looked at it as prostitution. And it was something that happened on street corners, and the police and maybe the public would look at the people involved as prostitutes, and they would get arrested or prosecuted, or maybe were looked at in a way that wasn't a flattering way to look at somebody. And I think there's been a sea change in most places, and we're now realizing that there have always been pimps, there have always been traffickers, and the people we thought were prostitutes were usually doing that because they were being forced to do that. But the game has changed now. It's the same thing, but it's been like amplified exponentially with the internet. And so it's this whole electronic landscape. It's just mind-boggling. And so, like, the recruiting happens on usually social media. And with the internet, there were these websites that traffickers could advertise on. And it's, you know, first it started on Craigslist. There was another site called Backpage. I don't know if folks are familiar with Backpage, but it was this site. And it had some legitimate purposes to it. People could use it, such as a Craigslist, to buy or sell things or look for roommates or various and other type of things, but they had an escort link. And so traffickers were using that to advertise victims of human trafficking, and then it just kind of started from there. And there were some other sites that started to be active as well, but Backpage was kind of like the super highway for this stuff. There were some indictments and some lawsuits. There were some clauses in federal law, and some of the initial lawsuits were not successful. Backpage took down the escort link, but then it was being done through a dating link on Backpage. Ultimately, April of 2018, the Department of Justice seized Backpage because it was facilitating so much human trafficking that the site no longer exists. It was completely taken over by the government, which was good in the sense that it wasn't facilitating trafficking anymore, but we have some software that enables us to kind of look at some of this stuff. And so Backpage was a US-based company we could write search warrants to, and we could try to collect that evidence to try to recover victims and build cases. When Backpage went down, other sites came to prevalence. Some are based in the US, some are based abroad. It's really hard to get a search warrant issued in another country. But traffickers are really savvy, and so now they're getting off of the websites and they're using other things like dating sites, they're using dating apps, they're using social media, they're using sugar daddy sites, and so this whole like myriad of different kind of venues that they can do this on. And so it's kind of enabled them to recruit and also unfortunately sell their victims, and they can advertise all over the place, and that's why it's so lucrative for them. So this is a quote from a pimp, and this was part of a book called The Pimp Game. And so I think it's relational, and it says, like, first I take her heart, then I take her body. You start to dress her, think for her, own her. if you and your victim are sexually active, slow it down. After sex, take her shopping. Hair, nails, fine. She'll develop a feeling of accomplishment. The shopping after a month will be replaced with cash. The lovemaking turns to raw sex. She'll start to crave intimacy and be willing to do anything to get back into your good graces. After you've broken her spirit, she has no sense of self-value. Now Pim put a price tag on the item that you've manufactured. And so I hate reading that, to be honest. I hate reading that. But it talks about how the nicety and the intimacy gets replaced with things that are raw and things that are graphic, and it's breaking the spirit, so that person doesn't fight back anymore. So, scouting and recruitment often comes from other young people, the bottoms. I think we have this kind of image of an iconic victim that is kind of snatched off the street, and that might happen, but I haven't really seen that in my experience of doing these cases. It could happen. Sometimes traffickers, they will engage young people in conversation at transfer points, bus terminals, shopping malls, places like that. But typically, you know, at least here in Madison, there are young people that are recruiting for the trafficker, and that's usually on social media or at school or other different places where young people connect. And the grooming is that Romeo Pimp thing of building trust, building a relationship, providing gifts. And then turning out is when it shifts and that the niceties go away and becomes very coercive and violent. So some of the characteristics are like physical assault and sexual assault. Many victims of human trafficking are also victims of sexual assault, and that can be before and or after trafficking. Traffickers will sexually assault their victims as well. And physical confinement, psychological manipulation, the verbal abuse, and systems of reward and punishment is a big one. And so when we've debriefed survivors of trafficking, and I just in my experience, like people that have been trafficked don't often like to be referred to as victims because they want to be empowered. And so often I refer to them as survivors. I think anybody that lives through that is a survivor. And so they'll talk sometimes about how food or water was withheld from them while somebody else got to eat and drink, and then it was withheld from them, and this person got to eat or drink, and that's how that's one of the methods that pimps control and maintain control of their victims. And so the lies and false promises is that we're going to get this money and we're going to split it at the end of the week, and that never happens, or we're going to get the apartment, or whatever the promise is. It's usually always false. So I want to talk about one of the most, in my mind, one of the most destructive parts of this is branding and tattooing. And so this is kind of a trademark of human traffickers, is they will often brand or tattoo the people that they're exploiting. And so they do that for different reasons. It takes away the person's identity, for one thing. And every time they look in the mirror, they have this permanent reminder that they are property of the person that's selling them and exploiting them. And it's there to remind them of that every time that they look at themselves. Pimps also do this as a way to tell other pimps that this one belongs to me and this one is mine. So it's often like a name or a symbol. It could be a name or symbol or initials. And so that's a big thing to look for also. And it can be really something that's really hard to look at. It just takes away that person's sense of self. So we talked about social media, and there are more like types of social media than I can probably keep track of. You know, like Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, I'm forgetting, but Yik Yak, Whisper, Pinger. There's like new ones that are coming up all the time, and it's really kind of hard to track. So if you are involved with young people, friends, family, children, grandchildren, it's always okay to talk to them about making sure that they know who they're speaking with. And so this is kind of actually from a case that I worked in. This is what a bottom communicated to a victim, just another couple of young people who became victims, and it was hey, you're really pretty, do you want to make some money, it's easy, message me. And so this whole thing about bottoms is complicated because they're still victims. And anybody that's a bottom and has been trafficked is always a victim survivor. But they also become part of this crime of human trafficking. So it's a really complicated thing for us to deal with. And so the way I've kind of reconciled it is that we still are compassionate. We try to provide as much help and resources as we can accomplish for them, but there also has to be some accountability, you know, if they're recruiting and bringing other young people into sex trafficking. So there's another organization that I work with a lot. It's called the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they're based out of Alexandria, Virginia. They have offices in Austin, Texas, in West Palm Beach, Florida, in New York State, in Southern California, and I think they have a satellite office in Dallas, and it's a phenomenal organization. They help find missing kids, both international and within the U.S. They do family reunification. They have teams of analysts that help law enforcement with internet crimes against children, child pornography, and they have analysts for sex trafficking, and so they're a tremendous resource for us. They have a really great website. If you want to go to their website as well, there's lots of information there. And this comes from them, and they're saying about 300,000 underage girls per year being sold for sex. This is a little bit dated. We also see that that boys and young men are also victims of trafficking. It's sometimes more challenging to report because of the shame in it. I talked to one male victim of trafficking, and he gave me a disclosure, but he was like shielding his face. He just wasn't able to look at me when he was making the disclosure. It was really sad. But they're saying the average of age of entry is 12 to 14 across the country, and it can be up to 15 times a day that a young person is sold for sold to adults that will pay for sexual services. So it's hard to measure, and then people ask, like, what's the size of the problem in Madison? How many cases do you have? And it's a question that I really can't answer. I have a general idea, but it's not. It's when somebody's a victim of a burglary or a battery or a theft, they call to report it. We get a case number, and a detective supervisor reads it, and it gets assigned, and we can track it. Trafficking doesn't work that way. There are so many reasons why a victim doesn't disclose. They're scared to death. They're scared that their family is going to be. They're scared that there'll be retaliation, that they may be abused and killed. They're afraid that their family will be killed. They've lived through this horrible thing, and there's so many reasons why it's such a scary thing to report. And so, it's often unreported, and we find out about it through different methods. And so, victims of trafficking will often not disclose it, and so sometimes it requires us to meet with them and build trust, and that might be over the course of 5 or 6, 7 times of just meeting and getting to know somebody before they finally feel like they can trust enough to make a disclosure. And that often involves working with nonprofits and advocates and other people that work collaboratively with us. And so it's not reported. Often we get reports and tips from the hotlines, from the healthcare industry. We get it through the travel industry. There's a Truckers Against Trafficking network, because this happens on interstates and truck stops. And so we get tips and we get information, but we have to establish this relationship before we can build trust and then get a disclosure. And so there's a company that was founded by Ashton Kutcher, the actor, and I believe Demi Moore when they were together, and it's called Thorn. And so he's been a tremendous advocate against human trafficking. And so they created this company, and it has software that enables law enforcement to monitor different websites where traffickers advertise victims. And so they can't monitor all of them, so they try to look at the 3 or 4 that are most prevalent in any city. And so I can go online, and I can look at what's posting in Madison, so I do that every day. And there are hundreds of ads that are posted here every day. And so some of them are reposted the same person, but they're posted throughout the day, sometimes hourly or every few hours. But
every day I'm seeing different ones, and I'm counting several hundred a day, and that's not capturing what's going on the dating sites, the social media, and the dating apps. That's only 3 or 4 of the websites. So that's probably just a fraction. So it's kind of hard to gauge, but I know that the problem is bigger than we probably think that it is. And so this was kind of interesting. And so this is from NCMEC, the National Center for Missing Exploited Children. And they said that 86% of the likely victims were in the care of social services when they were victimized. And so this, you know, sounds startling, and it's like significant, but it's a really hard thing. It's not a knock on human services. It's really hard to uncover when somebody's a victim of human trafficking. And I just think back to my early detective days, and I had a trafficking victim in front of me, and I was investigating something else, and I knew that there was some type of exploitation happening, but I didn't know about this enough to really recognize what it was. And so it's really hard to uncover, even if somebody's working with a person that's a victim of trafficking. And so this is a little bit, a couple of years old, and so there's a lot of training that's going on, and so I think that this number is probably less than what it is here, but it is something that's of note. So Dallas, Texas is kind of like the leading edge of combating human trafficking from a police perspective, and I think this was really interesting. So they have a small group of detectives there. They formed their unit, I think it was in 2005, and it's called the Sexual Exploitation Squad, I believe. And so they have, I think, 5 detectives, and so their task is like basically what I was just given, like you have the whole city jurisdiction, go combat human trafficking with young people. And so prior to that time, they were generating about 10 to 12 cases a year in the Dallas-Fort Worth, kind of greater Dallas-Fort Worth area. And so they were led by a guy named, he was a sergeant, his name is Byron Fawcett, and I got to meet him in training. He retired last year, but he was a phenomenal advocate for victims of sex trafficking. And so he and his detectives realized that they needed to find a different way of uncovering trafficking cases. And so they realized that, like we talked about before, the most likely victims are kids that are missing from home, high-risk kids that go missing from home. So they built a database. That's his picture, and he's testified on Capitol Hill about this, and he's a really great guy. But they created this database, and they were looking like what designates somebody as a high risk for being a victim, and they were looking at who goes missing 3 or more times a year in any given year from home. So they built this database to identify the kids that were going missing from home repeatedly, three to four times a year. And they started kind of proactively engaging them in the community and building trust. And so they started like developing like hundreds of cases, just hundreds and hundreds of cases. So they really like amplified their discovery of the cases that were going on. And so they also changed the protocol of how missing kids were treated. And so, you know, in the past, and sometimes it still goes on, and the law enforcement recovers somebody that's missing, and they cancel them in NCIC, which is the National Crime Information Center. That's how, you know, we know nationally somebody's missing or wanted, and then they bring the child home. So instead of doing that in Dallas, they bring them to talk to a detective who's trained to do these type of interviews, they offer them services and different things. And so he created this unit, proactively made these efforts, and they started identifying 200 to 300 juvenile victims every year. And it's just been like a phenomenal success rate for them in at least discovering, you know, who were their victims. And so so that their patrol cops are trained to look for the signs, and they have a center there called the LETO Center. I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but it's this like it's a facility where a victim of trafficking can go, and they can get, it's like a one stop place where they can get treated for multiple needs in the same place. It can be
education, it can be substance abuse, it can be trauma care. They can get treated for all their needs in one place, and they're protected while they recover. Trauma is a really intense type of thing, and it kind of it affects victims of traumatic things. It lives with them for the rest of their lives, and it requires like a really specialized form of treatment. The other thing I didn't talk about is drug addiction, and so there's kind of a opioid crisis in the country, and so traffickers will sometimes use that as a mechanism to control their victims. They may exploit or create an addiction. And so when we recover a victim, they may be suffering from a drug addiction, and that's something that often will sometimes make a victim try to get away and get back to their trafficker because they're sick from their drug addiction. So that's another thing to look at. So Sergeant Fawcett, he said, we try to stabilize the child, and in the process, we end up getting the perpetrators. So he said that it's really important to try to extricate the young people from that life because of the psychological changes and the lack of the destruction of self-esteem. And once somebody's in it, it's kind of hard to get out, and that's been really challenging and difficult for me is trying to work so hard to help somebody, and then we try to get them help or get them out, and then they end up getting back involved again. So just some of the challenges is like the negative stigma, maybe not seeing themselves as being worthy of receiving help. Someone that's a survivor, their self-esteem is destroyed. They feel like they're just being used over and over again, and that they won't be respected or looked at in a positive way. And so we really need to use wraparound services and advocates and build back that self-esteem. So I'm going to just... Trauma bonding, that's the thing that's really hard to understand. And so that's... kind of talked about this earlier, but that's when that person that doesn't have, that had low self-esteem maybe and is romanced by Romeo Kim and is being mistreated in some way, there's like a skewed sense of loyalty and or maybe just a hope of trying to, just some hope that it can get back to the way it was at the beginning. And so it's hard to understand, but sometimes a survivor of human trafficking can bond with their offender over time. And part of that is also because of the isolation. They're kept away from their family. They don't have anybody else in their orbit. They're just the only person they have access to is their trafficker. So, these are kind of slides that Jan Miyasaki uses from Project Respect. It's more like treatment-oriented. A lot of the kids that we encounter are involved in the juvenile justice system, have various challenges going on. The iconic victim is somebody that's kind of like pulled off the street, that's going to be rescued and be willing to just talk about everything that happened to law enforcement. That's sometimes, but very, very rare. It's just these are high-risk people or high-risk young people that are being recruited and groomed and isolated. And so it's that whole process of trying to combat the drug addiction, if there is one, the trauma bonding dynamics, all the other perfect storm of things that are going on. Sometimes kids have all this chaos at home. They have a turbulent adolescence, and they have all these other things, and it's sort of everything at once. So one of the things is just to be authentic, and if you know somebody that's a survivor of this, just to let them know that they matter, that they're important, that they have self-worth. Tangible needs we had before. So housing and treatment is the big one. So there's a task force in the state, and they're looking at having a regional facility in every part of the state. We had one in this region. It was operating for a little while. It wasn't able to handle initially the scope of the problem. So there's another one that we're using. It's not in Madison. It's in another region. But there's work underway in the state to have a regional response to human trafficking. With young victims, it's hard when they're juveniles. There has to be like a court appointed or if a young person's going to go into like a residential treatment, it has to either be like with parental consent or something that's arranged through the courts. But there are adult victims and they're in need of shelter and treatment as well.
I have a question.
Sure.
Location. Mm-hmm. You said take a motel.
Mm-hmm.
These must be. These motels probably go where? I mean, if you see that kind of.
Yeah, it's
people going Roger. In and out.
Would you repeat your question?
So the question is about like motels and hotels and the staff. If I understand, are they seeing it going in and out? That's a great question. So. Yeah, our partners in this collaboratively are the people that operate and work in hotels and motels, and so some of them cooperate, some of them don't cooperate. I would say that the majority of them are cooperating because they don't. It's not good for their business to have this going on, and so there's a woman in St. Louis. Her name is Kimberly Ritter, and she. She came up here for a training, and so she used to work, I think she worked for a Catholic diocese, and part of her job was to book venues for I don't say if they're conventions, but if they're these big gatherings, her job was to kind of facilitate the events and you know, book hotel space for these events. And so she realized she's in these nice hotels, and this trafficking is going on all around her when she's there for this, like, these faith-based events. And so she started this company, and there's an app, you can put it on your phone, it's called Traffic Cam. And so what it is if you go to a hotel or a motel for a legitimate purpose and you just want to take a picture of the room, it gets uploaded to a database. And so if we, as law enforcement, if we have a picture of a missing trafficking victim and we don't know where they are, and we have a picture of them in some motel room, we can upload it to Traffic Cam, and it can search. It looks at like the schematics of the room, the bedspreads, the furniture, the color of the carpet, all these things. And so it can try to help us identify the franchise of the hotel or motel. And so that's part of what she does, but the other part is a certification process for these owners and operators of these hotels and motels. And if they go through this program, they can get a certification that they're doing something to mitigate like trafficking in their establishments. And so when I went to this training, there were people from the local hotels and motels, and some of them were very receptive, and they're cooperating with us because they don't want this in their establishments. And it happens in you know, inexpensive motels, and it happens in expensive motels and hotels. And trafficking follows events. It could be sporting events. It could be other things of that nature. And so not every motel cooperates, but I think a lot of them are starting to do that because they don't ultimately want that in their business.
And the other question is, where do all these lowlifes come from? That, I don't mean the pimps, I mean the people that are paying money to use these children.
Okay, so the question is about where are the people coming from that are purchasing the children? So they come from every walk of life, and they are typically men, but they're from what I hear, and this is what I've learned from actual survivors of human trafficking, they are everybody. They are your mail carrier, your teacher, your attorney, your police officer, your clergy person. It could be your, you know, coach of a youth team, accountant. I mean, they're just a full spectrum of people that have addictions or can purchase sex. And the thing about the internet is they don't have to go trolling the streets. They can be in the privacy of their home, their office, their car, and they can just go online on their phone and they can make arrangements to purchase somebody for sex. And so
But these are children. They know they're purchasing children. Obviously, when they get together with the child.
Right. I mean, there are adult victims of trafficking, and some are in the late teens, some are early teens, some are 12. You know, we talked about. So I would say that they know that some of them are connecting with adults, but it's very common to have juvenile victims, and so they're just a segment of average segment of unfortunately of society. So they come from every profession and every socioeconomic class and ethnicity and race. Religion. Yeah. So, questions?
I don't want you to give away the trades, of course, but how are you preparing for the convention and the summer in Milwaukee?
Oh, good question. So the question is about how we're preparing for the summer in Milwaukee, and I don't know the answer to that. Milwaukee is a... We're going there. You know, they're asking for law enforcement help from all over for the security issues. I'm sure that they have a response to trafficking. I just haven't talked to anybody there. They have, I believe they have 3 detectives that work in Milwaukee. We have the Department of Criminal Investigation. They have 6 agents that work across the state in human trafficking cases. The FBI has agents that work human trafficking cases, and we all work together. And so my educated guess is they're preparing for that, but I'm not sure what their plans are, to be honest.
Well, are people being arrested?
Right, so the question is, like, are people being arrested? And so there's 2 sides of this. And so in my new role, I'm looking at ways to do this. And so ultimately, we want to arrest the traffickers, the ones that are trafficking the victims. And so that's a challenge, you know, and so we have to try to build that trust and get the disclosure. We have to get the evidence, which we can get, but if it's electronic evidence that's coming from a website that's based in Europe or something, it's not always easy. To try to get a case to trial with a survivor is really, it's very traumatic for them to have to go through in court, in public, and talk about these things. And so what I do is I try to make the strongest airtight case that I can get, and I try to get every shred of evidence that I can get. And so the case is so airtight that it's likely not to go to trial. There'll be some type of a plea. But we always want to get the trafficker, but the other side of this is the people that are the demand side, the Johns, we call them. And so if there wasn't a demand for this, these guys wouldn't be trafficking people or trafficking children. And so that's another part of this. And so I think that we need to do things, and we need to start addressing the demand side, and whether that's through law enforcement and in addition to training, treatment, counseling, whatever. I think that we have to look at it from both the demand side and the traffickers. I'm sorry. Sir?
When these children are met a police officer, they're minors, and you mentioned that some of them are already in the juvenile justice system. So, I mean, how does that work if the police officer does engage one of them? They immediately have to try to determine, you know, the rights of the child. Who's looking after that? What legally? Do you have to go to a judge right away, or how does that work before you can take care of the child?
Okay. So the question is, law enforcement encounters a juvenile victim, and then do we have to go to a judge or the courts to try to take action? So there's mandatory reporting. So like, some agencies are mandated reporters. So if they have a juvenile victim that, if there's a suspicion of human trafficking, it needs to be reported to Child Protective Services. And then there's been a change in the law, so Child Protective Services does follow up on non-caregiver cases that involve likely trafficking victims. Law enforcement is a mandated reporter. So if there's a juvenile victim, we investigate. We need to determine, you know, where they're supposed to be, who has jurisdiction with them, with the courts. If a juvenile is on supervision through juvenile justice or with human services, there's different types of supervision. It could be because there's some criminal or delinquency petition. It could be because they're at risk because of things in their home life. So we have to work within the courts and work within who has custodial rights of them, but we're mandated to investigate and take action and to work with Child Protective Services.
Okay. Sounds very complex.
It's really complex. Like an adult, if there's an adult that's a victim, it's still not easy. But getting them treatment and placing them in safe places is extreme. It's much easier than a juvenile, because we can't take a juvenile into we can't take them from where they're supposed to be and place them somewhere else without court approval. So it's very challenging. So we have to work through the courts and through human services. I think Briar Patch Services, they have a shelter, but they have to go and have a hearing within a certain amount of hours if they're going to shelter a child there. Yes?
I'm going to have one opinion and then a kind of a question or a statement.
Sure.
One opinion is, I wish we would quit whitewashing this.
Yeah.
This is rape trafficking. Mm-hmm. It is not sex trafficking. It sounds so whitewashing. And talking about them being human traffickers, we should call them rape traffickers or slavery traffickers. We need to name it and make it as vile as it is. Mm-hmm. That's one statement. The other statement is, for people that don't know, there's a movie out there called My Name is Jane Doe. It's an excellent 2-hour movie, very gut-wrenching. But that movie talks about a federal law that was put in 1997.
If I understand, that was about Backpage. There were these three lawsuits. There were survivors of trafficking, and there was a federal clause that protected the people that were...
third-party people that put something on a website. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, on my Facebook page, if I wanted to put some words on there that was something about rape trafficking, I could do it without Facebook being reliable or responsible for it, because it's mine. I'm a third party. And that's how Backpage got away from it, is all these lawsuits that were done, and Backpage made millions, like 700 to 1,000 or almost $1 billion worth of money. So they had money to essentially pay for those lawsuits, and it was, I think, it was federal law 260 or something like that. And it's still on the books to this day. And what's happened is our internet use and how we use it has changed, but that law has not been updated. And if there's anything that we should do, is we should talk to our legislators and really pound on them to get that law to change, to make it more fitting to what the internet use is now.
No, I agree with you. So that documentary, it's really powerful. I think there were three specific stories about that. And so Backpage was supposed to hire monitors to monitor this stuff, and it didn't happen the way it was supposed to. And I'm not sure how the DOJ did it, but the site doesn't exist anymore because they took it over. But that problem is still a problem.
Because these dating apps, even.
Right,
some
right.
So put something on the dating app, and then the person that owns the dating app can say, oh, not my fault, because this is third party. Someone else posted something.
Right. So your legislation is totally the right answer. I couldn't agree with you more. And so if you go to, if you should talk to your local legislators, and there are some here that are very receptive to this, you can go on Polaris.org and you can sign petitions for that. There's a organization called FacesandVoices.org based out of Chicago, and they can bring this project to a city. It's called the Ugly Truth Campaign. And so, like you were talking about, it's like it's rape trafficking. So there's this whole myth that like purchasing sex from an adult is like a victimless crime. And so like this Ugly Truth Campaign, what they do is it costs money to have it come to a city, but they put these like huge signs and billboards and posters everywhere, and they'll say like the myth is that like prostitution is a victimless crime, and then it'll say the ugly truth is, and then it goes into how destructive it really is, and that it is like rape trafficking. Or so some of the way that that's been used in other places is these billboards are in places where legislators have to drive past on their way to work, and so it's been like instrumental in getting legislation passed. And so it's been in several cities. We're kind of looking at it in different places here. So that's something that's something that we're looking at, but I think your legislation is really powerful. It's a very powerful tool, for sure. Yes?
Well, I'm curious. You're talking about victims/survivors. How do you find a survivor if they're so controlled and everything?
It's challenging, so we can find them, and sometimes we try to do outreach, and you know, an outreach is accomplished not just from law enforcement, but by other organizations, to trying to intercept a, a survivor in the street is like a very dangerous type of proposition, because like there are like teams that go out and do recoveries, but traffickers are usually armed and they're very dangerous, and so that's a dangerous type of thing to do. And so we work with we do recovery operations sometimes if we have a person that we think is a victim, if they're missing. We can do different types of law enforcement operations where we have resources and safety plans, and we can try to do a recovery and then get them into treatment and get them help. But it's a challenge. I mean, it's not always easy. Sometimes it's you're doing outreach and you're trying to connect with somebody, and you're just saying, hey, my name is Roger. I'm here to help you. Can we just talk? We don't even have to talk about this if you don't want to today. I just want to get to know you. And then you build that trust, and then you try to develop a rapport. But there's different ways, and it's not always easy. And these survivors are moved around from city to city, and that's how we sometimes track them is through the ads. Because if the same person is being posted in Madison today, in Milwaukee the next day, in Chicago the 2 days after, we at least know kind of the general vicinity where they are. And so we have to work with other law enforcement agencies and try to do those recoveries.
So 12 years old is like a sixth grader.
Mm-hmm.
Are they talking about this at all in the gym classes? And
yeah.
Are the kids aware of? I mean, our daughter's older now, so we don't think about that. But I sure think they are. And parents need to be on top of things.
Right.
Where's your child?
So the question is, are they talking about this in schools? And it's a really good question. We have this Dane County Coordinated Community Response Team to Human Trafficking, and so one of the things that it's a collaborative group, and there's some law enforcement, but most of the people in that group are from other organizations that work collaboratively to address this, and so we're looking at some curriculums that would address that in school districts. I know, like in MMSD, I think to get something introduced in the curriculum, I'm not sure how exactly that works. I know they have tight space for different things that are required in the curriculum, but we're looking at, we looked at one organization. We had an interview, a presentation by Skype of this program that's being offered, this one program. It looked pretty promising. And then there's another one that we're looking at, and we met with somebody from the school board to see if maybe we could introduce it in a pilot project or a health class, if it couldn't be, you know, for everybody. But I think that's ultimately has to go through a school board or somebody that has.
Well, then let's get going.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, that's just to affirm that if my 8-year-old is learning what he's learning on the computer, there's no reason.
Right.
They can, I mean, okay, the curriculum and getting it through, but I do see opportunities for that.
Yeah.
Young kids.
And also, like this online gaming, there are kids that play online gaming, and they are virtual rooms or whatever realities. I don't know. They don't always know who they're talking to. So, yeah, Ron.
So I work with Slave Free Madison, and I do a lot of outreach. What we find is the best way to get into schools is have teachers approach us. So the 10th grade health curriculum requires some discussion of human trafficking. So I speak at East West Memorial Shabazz in the fall of every semester. That's the grade 10 classes. I've had in the last couple of weeks a bunch of middle school teachers contacting me about reaching into those groups. That's the place we'd like to go to.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily easy to go through the school system first and have them implement something and then come in. It's easier for us to have teachers invite us into their classrooms, because we can get bypassed everything else. Teachers hear about it, they contact other teachers, and that's one of the better ways to get that information disseminated within the school.
Right. And like Slave Free Madison is one of the biggest partners, and you facilitate like public events for people to learn about this, and I think that's like, this is great, because if you take something from this and you contact your legislators and your school boards and people that have control over budgets and laws, I mean, that's, I think, the best, most effective way to fight for this, or to fight this. Yeah. Yes?
Are gangs involved in this?
Question, are gangs involved in this? There are gangs involved in this. So, like, historically, there have been, like, decades past and into the present, some, like, outlaw biker gangs, but there are some street gangs that are involved in this. But typically, like what I'm seeing is it's more like organizations of traffickers, that like small like groups of traffickers, like small cells of traffickers. Sometimes with the gangs that involve like younger gang members, they might have
this happened at parties. It's not necessarily posted online with like the sophistication of posting things online. And so to post ads online, sometimes it, there's been efforts to make that more difficult, and sometimes it like requires having to use like cryptocurrency and different things like that. It's there's been some efforts, like traffickers used to buy these like Green Dot preloaded cards, like preloaded debit cards, like at a Walgreens or someplace, and they could just use that to post ads. And there's been some efforts to make that more difficult, and so it takes some knowledge to do that. So I think some of the younger gangs, it's they have things like this that happens at parties and different things, but for a lot of the online things, it's mostly older people. Yes, sir.
Do you go after the traffickers, or there's some other group that goes after the traffickers?
No, we go after the traffickers, but it's if you have a trafficker and they're operating in different jurisdictions, it becomes challenging, because like I have authority in Dane County, but I may have a trafficker that's committing a crime in Dane County, but they're also committing crimes in Illinois or other cities and things like that. And so like I'm working a case now. It's a federal case, and so it requires like law enforcement has to work cooperatively with other law enforcement agencies. So that's local, state, DCI, Department of Criminal Investigation, and usually FBI. And we work with local prosecutors, but often like with the U.S. Attorney when we have multiple jurisdictions. So it's, we go after them. They're not always here when we, like, we have to develop probable cause to arrest them or get an arrest warrant issued for them, but they may not be here. They may be somewhere else. So we have to try to get them arrested wherever they are and then extradited here.
You mentioned about there's traffic, trafficking in other cities around here. Mm-hmm. Is there anything about Madison that is unique in the trafficking than Milwaukee or Chicago, other than the size of the cities?
Yeah, so like in some cities, they still have like street level trafficking on the street. They call that walking the track on the street. And Madison doesn't have much of that at all. It's mostly like a hidden underground internet type thing. And so people don't like equate Madison with a trafficking city. It's a beautiful university city. And I think the thing with here is that there hasn't typically been a response to trafficking before. We don't have like a human trafficking. We just had our first position, which is a full-time position. And we have DCI and FBI, but I think when we start doing like the demand suppression work, my hope is that we get the word out and we get more cases. That it's not, I mean, it's never been welcome here, but I'm hoping that we get the message across that it's not a place that this should be happening. But I think part of it is that you know, there hasn't been, it's a city where this has been able to go on undetected, but I think the bigger part is that our location is that we're in between other bigger cities, and we're by an interstate system. Or did you have a... I'm sorry.
Do you see this happening? Maybe people coming to Madison, they could be young mothers looking for a better position. They couldn't find a position. They're in Milwaukee, Chicago, other areas. They're thinking, I'm going to come to Madison and find a job. And then they get here, and they find out, oh, this is a whole lot harder than I thought. So are some of them going into this to support themselves? And what happens when you get a call from a hotel and the manager of the hotel says, I think you need to come over here, I've got something going on in the room?
Right, so the question is, are like young mothers or adults who are coming here to find work and can't find work, are they going into this? I'm really not sure. I see like some online, I see some people advertise that are definitely adults. I have like a mapping function, so I can see if they're also advertised in other cities, and if they're bouncing all over the place, then I know that that's not what it is. But if there's an adult that's advertised only in Madison and struggling, it could be that they're doing that on their own, but most of the time it's there's a trafficker involved. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of the question was?
What if you get a call from a hotel?
Okay, hotel.
And they would like to have someone come over.
Do yeah.
Do you go over? Do you take a team with you? What do you do?
So it kind of depends on the time of the day. So to be honest, we would send an officer. Usually they'll call me or something. And so we haven't had a team in the past to go. So We have one trafficking position, but I'm attached to the special victims unit, so I have six other detectives that could be a team. And so we would go to the hotel, and we would investigate that, but we would ask the hotel if they could provide us with information about who rented the room, who checked in, if there's video imaging of the people entering. So sometimes these traffickers will find a motel where they can use a side exit to bring the survivor in and out. But we want to try to get who's registering, who's filling out the form, if there's a photocopy of their driver's license, their license plate. So a lot of the motels that are cooperating, they do photocopies of that information, and sometimes they're even making visitors identify themselves. And they have there is one motel that has turned that information over to us, and there are other motels that have called us. So it's working. And then, just one quick second. Sir?
Well, what's your conviction rate? I have a feeling it's not very high.
I've had like several cases that have gone, through the court system, and we've gotten convictions in all of them. They haven't always been trafficking convictions. Like sometimes they'll plead to a solicitation of a child for prostitution, which is a felony. And so it mostly has to do with going with a prosecutor to talk with the survivor and trying to find out, are they willing to go to court? How do they feel about testifying? What do they want to see? What outcome do they want to see? And so some of them don't want to come to court, and they don't want to do that. And so we kind of have to honor, what's best for them too. And so, but also try to protect the community. So I think if they don't go down for like the trafficking conviction, sometimes they'll get a conviction for a related offense. And so we've had convictions in I think all of our, and I'm not speaking about me, but our local cases through DCI and the feds, we've had, we seem to have convictions. Sometimes they're for other offenses, but related offenses. And then, I'm sorry, ma'am.
Where is this happening, though? I mean, what parts of town? I just can't imagine that people wouldn't notice this. It's not like Madison's a big city.
No, so the question is, like, where is it happening in the city? And I'll tell you that it happens all over the city. And so, They move, so it happens a lot of times. There's things called, there's in-calls, out-calls, and car dates. And so a car date is when it happens in a car. It could be in a park, in a parking lot, in some dimly lighted cul-de-sac. We have some parks that are kind of out almost in the county. It could be anywhere. An in-call is like in a motel or an apartment or a residence where the person who's purchasing the sex or the rape is coming into that one location, and an outcall is when, like, a trafficker brings a victim survivor to the John. And so it could be anywhere. So we see a lot with the motels that are by the interstates. There's some inexpensive motels by the interstates seem to be big ones, but it's kind of all over the city. It's not like confined to a specific neighborhood.
They
do, but they change management sometimes, and so a lot of them are very cooperative, and some of them are aware of it, and some we struggle with. But we like Project Respect and the CCR team. We do this initiative every August before school starts. It's called Operation Giving Hope, and so we contact one of these motels, usually by an interstate system, and we set up like stations where we get donations, and we can go room to room and see if transient families or people that are in the rooms, if they need food, if they need medical care, if they need mental health care, if they need backpacks for their kids, if they want to register their kids for school, we can go station to station and then try to see if we see any signs that somebody's a victim of trafficking, and then we can try to offer services. And so we approached one of the motels that we thought was kind of problematic, and they were really enthusiastic about having us do this initiative on their property. So I think that was a good thing. So I think most of them are cooperating. Yes, sir.
Is there any crossover with the human traffic industry and the pornography industry?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Is there a crossover with the two industries? I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. I think there's some thought that like pornography is a form of trafficking because it's exploiting somebody, and then the people who are buying it are they're not buying like physical sex, but they're buying, they're purchasing being able to view somebody having sex. So it's like, it is looked at that in some, by some as trafficking. I'm not sure what the, I'm not sure if this, to be honest with you, I'm not sure the answer to that. I think that there's some like local people that try to do like not necessarily like high production pornography, and there might maybe some there, but I haven't had any cases like that.
Are you getting tired? That was a slew of really good questions, deep thoughtful questions. I think you've made an impact.
Okay, thank you very
much.
And
I don't know if you've gotten through your
I think we got through enough of it, so yeah, that's fine.
People are really